Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with today's White House visit by the Greek Prime Minister Antonio Samaras, where Obama called for a balance between austerity and growth so the Greek people could see a light at the end of the tunnel. The director of the Center for Hellenic Studies at Simon Fraser University, Andre Gerardimatos, joins us to discuss today's announcement that unemployment in Greece had reached a record 27.6%, with youth unemployment at 60%. Then we'll look into the extent to which the Israeli public is being prepared for a war with Hezbollah, following a briefing yesterday in which senior military officials warned that the next war with Hezbollah could involve up to 100,000 longer-range, more accurate rockets with larger warheads than the 4,000 that rained down on Israel in the 2006 war. Daniel Byman, a professor at the School of Foreign Service at Georgetown University and author of A High Price, The Triumphs and Failures of Israel's Counterterrorism, joins us to analyze these latest rumors of another war. Then finally, we'll hear from Background Briefing special correspondent at the 40th ALEC Convention in Chicago, Lauren Windsor, the host and producer of The Undercurrent on the Young Turks Network. Along with most of the press, she was denied access to the secretive meetings between mostly Republican state legislators and the corporate-funded American Legislative Exchange Council, whose model bills like the Stand Your Ground legislation continue to be adopted around the country. We will discuss how the protests outside resonated on the secret meetings taking place on the inside. Joining us now is Andre Gerardimatos, who is the director of the Stavros Niarchos Foundation Center for Hellenic Studies at Simon Fraser University in Vancouver, British Columbia, and a specialist in military and diplomatic history. His books on Greek history include Red Acropolis, Black Terror, The Greek Civil War, and his latest book is Castles Made of Sand, A Century of Anglo-American Espionage and Covert Operations in the Middle East. Welcome to Background Briefing, Andre Gerardimatos.
Thank you.
So tell me, what do you expect or imagine went on today at the White House with Prime Minister Antonis Samaras of Greece meeting with President Obama? Just coincidentally, on this day, we find out that Greek unemployment has reached a record high of 27.6%, with almost two-thirds of young people in Greece without a job. So that, I imagine, must have come up in the meeting, right?
Very much so. And I think that Mr. Samaras is looking for, you know, support of any kind at this stage of the game. But, you know, support from the United States, especially President Obama, with the Germans, because the Germans have been insistent upon, you know, cut, austerity, which is not helping the economy really get going. Because, you know, of course, with austerity, people are not making money. They're not spending money.
So what was the, apart from the, what the official statements say, that they talked about the transatlantic trade and investment partnership, what good will that do Greece? I mean, don't they, this austerity that's been rationed out by the EU has clearly crippled their economy, and it's created this record unemployment that we just mentioned. What good is this TTIP partnership going to do for them?
Well, again, I think it has to do with more moral support and the fact that it might encourage American companies and especially Greek Americans to consider investing in Greece, right? And especially if Mr. Samaras can convince these people that the red tape that exists in the country in terms of, you know, preventing businesses from operating has been diminished. Also, I think he wants to impress upon Mr. Obama and Americans in general that Greece is one of the few stable countries in the Eastern Mediterranean. When we look at what's going on in the Middle East in particular, there aren't that many places left that have any kind of political stability in relation to, you know, what is going on in the region.
But my understanding, one of the biggest problems in Greece itself, in as opposed to how much the European Union has been trying to get blood out of a stone here, and that the policies clearly have been wrong-headed and counterproductive, but there's also obviously a lot of blame to be laid, surely, in the way, for example, that the wealthy Greeks don't pay taxes. In fact, an awful lot of people don't pay taxes. So if your government's broke, that's a good place to start, isn't it? Start collecting taxes?
Very much indeed. But I think, you know, you're right. People traditionally have avoided paying taxes. The more money people had, the less taxes they paid in a bizarre way. Part of that is cultural and the fact that, you know, Greece – went through all these wars and all these upheavals, and people had a distrust of the state, and the state gave them back very little, so there was never any inclination to pay taxes. You know, in Canada, you pay your taxes because, you know, your taxes pay for Medicare, they pay for universities, they pay for schools, for roads, for police protection, to the same degree in the United States as well, and of course in Western Europe. But until recently, you know, the Greek state has offered very little in exchange for those taxes. So there's that element. The other is that the tax system itself is a bizarre collection of laws that make it very hard on the average person when they do pay their taxes. I mean, even the EU has commented repeatedly that the Greek taxpayer is one of the most overburdened taxpayers in Europe.
Let me again remind the audience, if I may, that I'm speaking with Andre Gerolimatos, who is the director of the Stavros Niarchos Foundation Center for Hellenic Studies at Simon Fraser University in Vancouver, British Columbia. He's a specialist in military and diplomatic history, and his books on Greek history include Rhodocopolis, Black Terror, the Greek Civil War, and the Origins of Soviet-American Rivalry, 1943 to 1949. And his latest book is Castles Made of Sand, A Century of Anglo-American Espionage and Covert Operations in the Middle East. And you made the point earlier, of course, that compared to what's happening in the neighborhood, Greece is relatively stable. Does this mean then, for example, there was a lot of concern about the emergence of a far right-wing party? And of course, on the left, you also have a new emerging party.
Yeah.
Are politics in Greece continuing to polarize with, I think it's New Dawn, right?
And that's right. New Dawn is a kind of a extreme right-wing, neo-fascist sort of party that has achieved some success. But, I mean, in terms of percentages, it's not very high. You know, and it is a reaction to the austerity measures that are going on. I think that would happen in any country, but I don't think that Golden Dawn is going to ever become the government, even or in a coalition government. The other left-wing party, Syriza, which is describes itself as a more revolutionary left-wing party, a more radical left-wing party, is trying very hard to become more of a socialist party. They plan to form a government, and most likely a coalition government. And to do that, they have to become a lot more moderate, you know, closer to the ruling coalition in terms of practices and policies.
So there's been, just in terms of the Prime Minister of Greece, Antonis Samaras, meeting with President Obama today, and just to try to figure out what can be done to reverse Greece's slide. And of course, you know, the Republicans have been using the notion of Greece as a sort of bête noire, you know, in terms of them selling austerity over here in the form of the sky is falling because of these deficits, which were never a problem, but the Republicans have turned them into a problem and used Greece as the poster boy for what could happen to America. And, of course, it's an absurd comparison, but that doesn't mean that they don't make it all the time. So let me just mention a couple of things here. In the recent Pew Research Center survey from March of 2013 found that only 22% in Greece said that Prime Minister Samaras is doing a good job in dealing with the EU economic crisis. So you got a prime minister who's meeting in the White House and only 22% of Greeks think he's doing a good job.
Well, you know, considering one-third of them don't have jobs and the rest of them are living in less than what they had before, I think it would be hard for any prime minister. In fact, it's remarkable that he has 22% under the present circumstances. You know, he's done a remarkable job considering what he has to work with. He surprised a lot of people that he's doing such a good job. He has to make a lot of tough decisions. He's got to live with the European Union, and he's got to live with the Germans. And there's no way around that unless, you know, a country like the United States can morally intervene and kind of help Angela Merkel see the light that development is as effective, you know, along with austerity. You know, the Germans, historically speaking, have a morbid fear of inflation. You know, during the 1930s, their economy went rock bottom, and inflation went through the roof. And as a result, they ended up with the Nazi Party and World War II and all the destruction that came with it. So, you know, they have a kind of a visceral reaction to anything inflationary. Other countries use inflation, they'll print more money to get past a tough period economics and get the economy moving and then, you know, scale back. So these are some of the cultural and some of the political developments that are hampering a Greek recovery.
But the idea of the U.S. being the answer or the solution or coming in on a white horse here, again, in this Pew survey from this year, Greeks express high levels of anti-American sentiment. 39% in Greece expressed a positive view of the United States. This is the worst measure of anti-Americanism, only exceeded by the publics in Turkey, the Palestinian territories, Egypt, Jordan, and Pakistan.
Yeah, so, I'm not surprised. Anti-Americanism has been a factor since 1973 and 1974 because of what happened with Cyprus. And it's become a kind of a cultural phenomenon. I don't quite understand it myself because, you know, I don't live in Greece and I go there and I speak to people. And you ask them, well, what is it about the United States you don't like? They can't really tell you with respect to Greece. They'll tell you, regarding Afghanistan or Iraq or the Palestinian situation. But then you say, well, what does that have to do with Greece? And they really cannot say much. The anti-Americanism, keep in mind, is also a factor of the Eastern Mediterranean. It is very, very powerful in places like Egypt and Syria, as well as Lebanon and Turkey, and, of course, Pakistan, Afghanistan, Iraq, and the rest.
So I was mentioning earlier from this poll that only 22% of Greeks said that the Prime Minister Samaras is doing a good job, and because he met today at the White House with President Obama. And the Greeks who were polled by the Pew Research Center in this March 2013 poll, only one-third of Greeks have confidence in the American president to handle international affairs, with 62% expressing little or no confidence. So, I don't mean to rain on their parade.
No, you're not. But you know what? If you do the same poll in Germany and France or England, maybe better in England, but I think on the whole, you're going to find about the same numbers vis-a-vis confidence in President Obama, especially in the light of, you know, what happened with the alert and with the closing down of American embassies, and then there was no terrorist strike, you know. Now, people, of course, can argue in the White House that they did that to prevent a terrorist strike, but from the point of view of people in Europe, they're all poo-pooing the United States as overreacting.
And you're talking about this recent alert.
That's right, yeah. So, you know, depending when you take a poll, right, there's right. What's going on in the world at that moment in time, it will be reflected in the poll.
So again, Andre Gerliamatis, the author of Castles Made of Sand, A Century of Anglo-American Espionage and Covert Operations in the Middle East. He's a professor of Hellenic Studies at Simon Fraser University in Vancouver, British Columbia. Let's turn a little bit to the work that you've been doing, because obviously the espionage is high on our radar here with the Snowden affair, which seems to have in part helped scuttle the summit between Putin and Obama in September. Every day there's a new revelation about the National Security Agency here, and there obviously you've been focusing in a lot of your work on espionage in the Middle East. Is there anything below the surface that could be worse than what's above the surface? I don't mean to be facetious, but what do we need to know that's secret there when so much of what is apparent is so appalling?
Well, you know, I think what is below that is probably more appalling. The secret world is secret for a reason. It's not a very nice world. It's a very dirty world. And countries, the intelligence services of countries do not behave like gentlemen. So one should not be surprised if the United States or Great Britain or France or Russia, they take off the gloves, and it's very, very dirty. It's a kind of a war in a fourth dimension where, you know, no holds barred. I mean, the Russians got their hands on Snowden. They're going to give him asylum. But, I mean, in exchange, he has to give them whatever he knows, and I'm sure he will. And that's a major blow, not so much of any current secrets, right? But it's tradecraft. It's how the secrets are collected and how does the agency, the NSA, functions. This is what has the United States so upset.
So, but in terms of the Middle East, what do you think American spies, British spies are doing there, and Iranian spies? I mean, the difference is that the Iranians and the Russians seem to know what they want in Syria. On the Western side, they don't seem to know what they want.
No, they don't. I don't know if the White House is listening to its intelligence community, but certainly the actions of the United States in the Middle East have been confused, to say the least, dangerous, and it's not doing America any good. I mean, initially the White House was very supportive of the Syrian opposition, only to find out that the Syrian opposition was not as lily-white as they thought, that they were as nasty because a lot of elements of al-Qaeda were in the opposition. I think the tendency in North America, and that includes Canada as well as the United States, we want to see good guys and bad guys, black and white. And in the Middle East, that does not exist. It's all shades of gray. And it's very hard for political leaders to explain to the population that it's all shades of gray. So they tend to err on the, black and white. Here are the good guys and here are the bad guys, Assad is the bad guy, the opposition are the good guys. Oops, they're not the good guys anymore. Well, what do we do now,
Well, but just in terms of intelligence, I'm not talking about black operations. I'm talking about political intelligence, which, every day the president gets a briefing. A lot of it's about, the black stuff and the gray stuff. But I talk about the white side here, which is analysis. Who the hell told the Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton, to go public so early and say that Assad was finished?
I don't think it was the intelligence community. America lacks a very important body, which the British have. You have a lot of intelligence agencies. Last count was 14 in counterintelligence agencies. There is no board, there is no agency that all that information goes into that provides analysis and interpretation that then is passed on to the president. He tends to get it from the different organizations. I mean, you have to feel sorry for the man. I mean, whenever he gets his briefing, he's going to get four or five briefings that may even contradict each other. And then, of course, you have his cabinet who decide to say things because it's politically expedient.
Well, recently the Defense Intelligence Agency leaked a report saying that they were the ones that had told the president from the beginning that Assad was not going to fall, that he was going to last a hell of a lot longer. So somebody was telling Hillary Clinton one thing and the president another.
Well, the State Department has its own kind of intelligence organization, so they collect their own information, and they tend to rely on theirs rather than the CIA or the NSA or the Defense Intelligence. The problem with the United States intelligence community is that it's too big, and it's too many agencies, and it's too much information overload, and that leads to very poor decisions.
So this whole idea of a Director of National Intelligence, this General Clapper, who's recently been caught lying to the Congress, which is not very reassuring. What's his function? I mean, this thing that they have at Tyson's Corner, the Counterterrorism Center, is often been referred to as a massive white elephant. I mean,
It is. They have some like 4,000 people working there and basically doing nothing because the intelligence agencies will not give them any information. They don't trust them with the information. So this was a kind of response to the 9/11 report that, something had to be done, so create another organization. That was the quick and dirty answer, which is sucking a lot of, taxpayers' money for nothing. They'd be better off closing these things down, having, a handful of very good intelligence agencies rather than these gigantic organizations, bringing in masses of information that no one's ever going to use.
Well, but as a result of 9/11 or in response to 9/11, my understanding, and this came out of the Snowden affair, that up to 70% of the U.S. intelligence budget now goes to private contractors.
Yeah.
I mean, that's a massive change. And I talked to a former CIA officer recently who a lot of people, as they leave both the Special Forces and the CIA, they get in touch with him because he's always on CNN and on television over here.
Yeah.
And they're all telling him how much they despise the poaching of the contractors who just grab people because they have security clearance and bump their salaries up, and then they charge that back, tenfold to the taxpayer.
Yeah.
It just feels like this massive boondoggle has taken place since 9/11.
It has indeed. It's terrorism, the war against terror has become an industry, and a lot of companies are feeding off that industry and have become very rich doing so. I mean, 70% is a huge number. Meanwhile, more intelligence organizations are created. And what are they for? And if they're going to go private, I mean, that's a huge mistake in the first place, because giving this to private companies, no matter how high their clearance is, they're private companies. They're working for a dollar. They're not working for their country.
So just in closing then, Andre Gerolimatos, we got away from Greece into your specialty, which is the history of intelligence, and particularly in the Middle East, and the Soviet-American rivalry in Greece, which of course began in 1949. That was the beginning of the Cold War, wasn't it? That was literally the first front in the Cold War, was it not?
Yeah, the Greek Civil War was a kind of a first clash between the Soviet Union and the United States. And it's interesting. It's a war that the United States won, and won very well. And yet all the wrong lessons were drawn from it for future conflicts.
Meaning what?
Vietnam. Right? I mean, if you look at some of the documentation, that some of the reasoning about Vietnam, they always hark back to the success that they had in Greece. But a very important difference is that the United States sent advisors, sent materiel, sent soldiers to advise Greek soldiers, but they never sent American troops on the ground to take part in the Greek Civil War, as happened in Vietnam.
So what we were just saying earlier from that poll that the Pew Research Center just conducted back in May of this year, of how incredibly unpopular the United States is in Greece.
But it wasn't always the case. You know, when I was a kid in Greece, America was the most beloved country. It was the most popular country. Up until the Turkish invasion of Cyprus, a lot of people convinced themselves that the United States had a role to play in favor of Turkey with the invasion of Cyprus, and they're still convinced by that.
Because the U.S. let it happen, right? I mean, it caught everybody by surprise.
It did.
In fact, you know, that is one of the rare occasions where nuclear weapons fell into the wrong hands, although it turns out that the Turks didn't realize they had it. They overran a British base in which there were bunkers with nuclear bombs, and it's one of those broken arrow incidents that nobody talks about.
Exactly. Very, very true. But, I mean, to set the record straight, I don't think the United States intervened in favor of Turkey. You're right. They simply did not intervene to stop Turkey, and that has been misunderstood as intervention on behalf of Turkey.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us, Andre.
You're very welcome.
Again, I've been speaking with Andre Gerolimatos, who is the director of the Stavros Niarchos Foundation Center for Hellenic Studies at Simon Fraser University in Vancouver, British Columbia, and a specialist on military and diplomatic history. His books on Greek history include Red Acropolis, Black Terror, The Greek Civil War, and The Origins of Soviet-American Rivalry, 1943 to 1949. And his latest book is Castles Made of Sand, A Century of Anglo-American Espionage and Covert Operations in the Middle East. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking about how the Israeli public appear to be being prepared for a war with Hezbollah.